June 6th meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to Order. We have a varied and full agenda, so we're going to plunge right in, and we will start by opening a work session on Senate Bill 989A. And Jim,
Madam Chair,
can you tell us about
Senate Bill 989A expands the types of public bodies exempt from the insurance code requirements related to health insurance coverage to include public bodies whose numbers of covered employees and dependents require employees and dependents at least 500. You have the -2 amendment, which simply declares an emergency so the bill would take effect upon passage.
Right, and I think we have, yes, Representative Maurer and Senator Richard, did you want to come forward on this, or are you just here for moral support? Okay, great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Representative Ron Maurer, serving District 3, which is most of Josephine County. Simply, the amendment adds the emergency clause, and that was an oversight on my part. I have a public body that is interested in pursuing self-insurance, and they want to do it as soon as possible, and their collective bargaining agreement comes around October 1st and want to do it at that point, and without this amendment they would not be able to do it. But besides that, this bill is good for the state of Oregon. It brings up to date some issues in self-insurance that cover all public bodies, and Senator Verger has a public body in her district, and this would be on Representative Roblin's district also, that is very interested in maintaining their self-insurance status, and this law is necessary for them to do that. So I would encourage your support of the -2 amendment. With that, I will close.
Okay, any questions for Representative Maurer? Okay, I think this is pretty straightforward.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 989.
Representative Buckley moves the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 989. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. And Representative Buckley?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 989A to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Buckley moves Senate Bill 989 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Shana, please call the roll.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative
Buckley?
Aye.
Representative
Hunt?
Aye.
Representative
Roblin? Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Maurer, would you like to carry this on the floor?
Yes, ma'am, I will. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 989. And... Okay. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 863A. And I think we're changing staff here to have Teresa tell us about this bill.
Thank you, Madam.
Teresa.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Senate Bill 863A prohibits callers from using automatic dialing and announcing devices if the phone customer incurs unwanted expense unless the phone customer has either requested or permitted the call and requires the devices to disconnect within 10 seconds after the call is used. The measure also describes the devices, which types of calls that phone numbers that the device has to block calls to, and also provides exceptions for the devices to be used, such as to callers who have an established business relationship with a customer, calls from emergency law enforcement agencies or schools, and callers that are regulated through the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And there's an emergency clause on the measure. It passed out of the Senate on a vote of 19 to 10. You have in front of you a -A6 amendment and also a hand and gross amendment for your review. The amendment clarifies exceptions for calls to be made to a no-call list subscriber if the caller has an established relationship with the customer, is a debt collector, represents either a public safety or law enforcement agency, and represents a school district if the subscriber is a school employee, student, or a parent or guardian or family member, or if the device is used only between the hours of 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. The amendment removes the definition provisions of the term unwanted expense, removes the current requirement for devices to block callers to pager, cell phones, or similar services, and also removes the emergency clause.
Great. Thank you for that speedy explanation. I see Representative Schaffler and also Senator Metzger, would you like to come forward? And
sure.
Then I believe Justin Black, did you have a desire to testify on this as well? Okay, if the three of you could all come forward and please tell us about this.
Let me start there.
Yes, sir, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And the reason Ms. Van Winkle did such a good job, she's already done that once, so she's very, very expert at that. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. Senate Bill 863, I know half the committee heard this bill as part of Senate Bill 982 last week. And the reason we're before here today is that a number of people had some thoughts about how to even improve the bill a bit more, and we were certainly open to that. And since the original bill was in this committee, we thought that would be the best way to do that, and appreciate the opportunity to bring it here today. I think Ms. Van Winkle gave you a pretty good overview of the legislation, and so I don't want to go, especially since a number of you have heard this in depth before, I think I'll just kind of go over through a few key points, what Senate Bill 863 and then what the amendment does. We started out, and if you have a, I don't know how extensive your bill file is, but when this started out in Senate Business and Transportation, we actually started this out with a constitutional amendment to really clamp down on the use of robocalls. Because of Oregon's constitution, we are limited into what we can do in that arena. And we had a number of very, very informative hearings on this bill, and in reality decided that the hill to climb over, you know, to pass the constitutional amendment to the voters and do all that probably was not going to be successful, at least the first time around. And so what we should do is take a look at the real harms. This is a tool that can be effective, but some people misuse that tool. So let's take a look at what the harms are and protect our citizens from those and use that as a starting point. So working with the Department of Justice, Pete Shepard is in the room if you have any questions, we asked the department to look at the specific harms that people may use these automated devices for and those that could be defended in court, and let's address those in this bill, and that's what happens in Senate Bill 863. Essentially, there are a number of things that it does, and make it very clear it does not ban the use of robocalls. Although personally I'd like to do that, but what it does do is put some significant sideboards on it. Number one, it prevents a caller from misrepresenting or falsifying the caller's identity or the identity of the person on whose behalf the call is being made. In committee last week, for those of you who heard, I used the story that's in your packet on the front page of the New York Times last month, in which a candidate for Congress in Nebraska had a call with his voice on it announcing he was running for Congress and asking for support that came at 3 o'clock in the morning, and to his constituents who, of course, we're not very pleased to have that political call. And, of course, the problem was it was a falsification because it was not his call. It was not his campaign that was calling. It was the opposition who had put it together to make it look like it was he who was making the call. Under this bill, you cannot falsify that information and say you are somebody which you are not. Secondly, it prevents a caller from misrepresenting the telephone number for which the caller is making the call. It prevents you from misrepresenting the location from which making the call is made, and it may not misrepresent the purpose for which the caller is making the call, and prevents the caller from manipulating the caller ID number from which the call is being made. Now, it does not prevent someone from blocking that number or seeing you exactly where it's coming from. That would be considered content, but you can't say you're calling from the Salem Chamber of Commerce on the ID when really, you know, you're calling from somewhere else. So, and that has been done, unfortunately, to misrepresent. It also says that if you must disconnect the line within 10 seconds after the subscriber terminates the call. Those who operate these businesses, that these machines are designed to do that. Some people have, however, used those to the detriment of the subscriber, where they'll actually grab the line and not release it for some time. It was interesting, on the day before this was heard in the Senate Business Committee, or the House Business Committee, a member of the Capitol Press Corps here called to say they had a robocall actually at their office phone, and they did. They grabbed the line, disconnected, they could not call out and make their news calls for a while, and was very upset about that. I said, well, timing was everything. And really appreciated their interest in the bill. It does, the only group of subscribers who are exempt from being called by robocalls, if you're on the national do not call list. And as I've always told people, it's from a political standpoint, the wisdom to consider actually calling somebody who has taken the time to affirmatively say they don't want you to call them. And of course that list can be supplemented anyway if you have a relationship with that individual. For example, if your union, you can then call those people if they've consented to that, if you're a member of Oregonians in Action or whatever, and you have a group and you've consented to receive those calls, then that of course would trump that. But otherwise it would have to have have the individual actually do something that's kind of old-fashioned, and that is actually make a real contact with someone and make or build a relationship and ask if they could receive additional information. So that's the actual crux of the bill. The amendment deletes the section about the unwanted expense. I think Representative Schaffer and I continue to think that's a pretty good part of the bill. However, there is some question as to whether the caller is really going to know whether there's an unwanted expense, particularly in the field of cell phones. And I think it's something that could be addressed later, particularly in political calls for those of us who use those. They use them off the voter list, and the research we have found that very few people put their cell phone down as their home number on the voter list. So at this moment in time, it's probably not as critical. We have taken the, as suggested by the Attorney General, we have moved some of the issues around. You notice that the Fair Debt Collection Act Practices Act, those who are subject to that, actually, after reading that act, are much more regulated than this bill is. But we still apply that to the Do Not Call list to make sure they have some comfort with that. And then finally, we had a suggestion. And I think Representative Rosenbaum, it may have been your suggestion, I thought it was an excellent one, to add an additional harm, and that is to make sure that if you do a robocall, that you can only do it between the hours of 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. And not in the evening. And then finally, as Ms. Van Winkle pointed out, we did delete the emergency clause in the bill. So that's that summary, and I turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you, Mike Schaffler, State Representative, House District 48, Happy Valley, Southeast Portland. Thanks for having us, Madam Chair. In the end, this is what Oregonians want us to do. Plain, flat out, simple. This is what our constituents, 98% of our constituents, want. I have a couple of examples here. One robocall recently to my district said I supported allowing illegal aliens to have a driver's license. That's just a flat out lie. They're lying about me and my record. They're lying, and people don't want lies spewed into their home like this. There was another one, the robocall industry, saying that these robocalls help elect poor people to the legislature. Well, you know, guess what, folks? There are no poor people in the legislature now with these calls. What makes us think there are going to be fewer poor people without them? It just isn't true. This is not going to totally ban these, although I look forward to you all helping me banning them outright in the future. It'll allow people to ban them in their homes. Now, imagine if somebody, foolish person, came to my door, and I was sitting out on my deck enjoying myself with a cold beer and a cigar, and my wife came back and said, honey, there's a man standing in our doorway that says his free speech trumps our privacy. Now, that individual would find their civil rights broken all the way out to the gutter where they belong, but at least they'd have enough guts to come to the house and try it. These calls allow them to intrude on our privacy. And forgive me, but no one's free speech trumps the privacy of my wife and daughter. Period. End of story. In our home. This is a great bill. 98% of Oregonians want this to happen, and I look forward to hearing this on the floor and passing it, making the law. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for your comments, and thank you for your willingness to continue to work to improve this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's been accomplished. Are there any questions for our witnesses?
Cool.
Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, gentlemen. Representative Schaffer, you did bring up the existence of false calls. On the bill we're looking at, that's not going to be able to make any difference. I mean, some can still, within these parameters, you can still call up and make those erroneous claims.
Unless, Madam Chair, Representative, unless they're on the no-call list, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And they do whatever they want, and they will.
And that's your one follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up.
Just to confirm, gentlemen, the $5,000 fine is per call if it's a violation?
Yeah, and Pete Sharp can ask about that. As you know, in the legislature, we have dozens and dozens of laws that are subject to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which has a maximum of $25,000 per incident. This is the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and we actually, I think this is the only one that may be in statute, or at least a prospective statute, that we actually lowered to $5,000. It's not because, and as Mr. Shepard would tell you, they don't actually assess that, but it was more of a point that we were trying to make. It wasn't, you know, trying to ding people with money. Just, you know, don't call people that don't. They'll want to be called, and so we lowered that more as a statement. But as the Attorney General is saying, I think you may have heard, I don't know if this committee heard the standard no-call bill, the Senate Bill 117. I don't know if that went through your committee. That's been on the books, as you know, for almost a decade with the same Unlawful Trade Practices Act until we became part of the national, and now combining back. And they don't use that authority, very generously. People make mistakes, and the Attorney General doesn't waste their time and resources to do that. What they will do is, when they have real bad actors, in which they get hundreds and hundreds of reports about one particular caller, and under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, their first act is actually to send a letter and to detail the complaints and ask them not to oblige. And it's only when they go way down the line and refuse to comply that those particular penalties could apply.
Madam Chair, if I may, we struggle to get people to serve in public service. I don't know how many thousands of opportunities people have to fill spaces to provide public service to this community. How much is a malicious lie on someone who's interested in public service worth? I mean, really, the people are prevented from getting involved in public service for that very reason. They don't want their good name and their family dragged through the mud. So $5,000, if you're a lying, no good scoundrel, is cheap. We're letting you off cheap, in my humble opinion.
Thank you, Representative.
Yes, Representative Thatcher. Thank you. I agree with you. This is probably what people want. I am concerned that how would you know whether somebody's cell phone is being called now that numbers are portable versus a landline?
Well, I'll address that, Representative Thatcher. Thank you. Actually, that is the part of the bill that we've deleted. The reports that we have received from those who run this is that the cell phone prefixes are registered, and the people that do these robocalls, when they actually go through and they glean their list, can delete those. But there was still some question as to whether everyone, especially, you know, small operators, would have access to that kind of technology. And so in this amendment, Representative Thatcher, we did delete that for that very reason, just so that, at least for the current time and place, it might be a robocall. I understand members of the House have been getting robocalls from robocall companies the last couple of days. So asking them to vote against robocalls. But we've deleted it just for that purpose, Representative Thatcher, so that that issue won't be a factor.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Justin, did you want to come forward and briefly tell us your reaction to these amendments?
Hey, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Justin Black from the Oregon Education Association. We represent about 47,000 members who work in the education community from kindergarten to community college. First of all, I'd like to thank the Chair, Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Schaffler, and Senator Metzger for all their hard work on this bill. I think with the amendments, this is a great bill, something that can really get the bad actors out from doing the bad stuff, but yet keep advocacy groups like us in the game and able to help people participate. So thank you very much, and great bill. Should pass, as they said.
Okay. Yes?
No? No
okay.
Questions?
Thank you very much for your comments. Members, we are in a work session, and yes,
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A6 amendments to Senate Bill 863.
Representative Berger moves the -A6 amendments to Senate Bill 863. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 863 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 863 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Yes,
I do have one exception. Maybe you can clarify for me, who gets the fine? Is it the people directing this company to make the call? Like he was, Representative Schaffler was complaining, a call was made falsifying what he had said. Would it be the company making the call, or would it be the actual person or group authorizing and instructing that?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, it's the company that's making the phone calls that would receive the fine.
Okay. Okay. Further discussion? Shana, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. And the bill will go to the floor. And Representative Berger, would you like to carry this?
I would be honored. My only problem is I don't think I can carry it with quite the passion of Representative Schaffer, but I'm sure he will help.
Madam Chair, suggest maybe call Representative Schaffer and...
I've had a discussion with Representative Schaffer. I feel confident he will be speaking about
it. I think so, too.
With the same passion he has brought to it all throughout. So. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 863 and open a work session on House Bill 3432. And members, I believe we have yet another amendment, but hopefully the last one we will see to House Bill 3432. And Mr. Stembridge, could you please tell us about
what's the number on?
Yes, members, this is the bill that reduces the number of members on the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training, BPSST. The amendment actually increases the number of members from 24 to 25, but it makes three of them ex officio non-voting members. The dash 8 is just like the dash 5 that you saw last week, except that it requires one of the representatives of the county or state corrections facility collective bargaining units to be from the largest bargaining unit of the State Department of Corrections. I believe you have the dash 8 in today's packet.
We do, man.
Good night.
Yeah, we do.
Yep.
Thank you. Okay, members, we've had a lot of discussion and testimony about this bill over the last week, so I think that we are in a work session.
Just so everybody's clear, the reference Jim mentioned, if you're looking through all these pages, I believe it's at the top of page 3. Mm-hmm. The one change from the dash 5s to the dash 8s that Jim mentioned, where it clarifies that one of whom, page 3, line 3, one of whom shall be a representative of the collective bargaining unit. Is that the reference you're making, Jim?
Yes. Yes, it is.
And if I could just ask a clarifying question of Jim, Madam Chair.
Sure. Go ahead, please.
This version, like the dash 5, just does not get into the issue of arbitration, unlike the dash 4, 6, and 7, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, that's correct.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, as we're in work session, I wonder if I could move the dash 2 amendment to 3432.
Yes, I believe that we discussed the dash 2 amendment at our previous hearing, or at our first hearing, actually. If you could remind us of what that
is. This is the one brought to us by Representative Crummell. Have we already added it?
I thought we already added the dash 2 our last hearing.
I don't think we discussed it. It was a very narrowly focused amendment around revoked certification and giving one more chance after 5 years for recertification in very narrow circumstances.
Correct.
Madam Chair, I don't believe that we've added it, but I think there would be no harm in adding it twice.
Okay. Yeah, and I think we had Representative Crummell testify, but I don't think we had to. So, your motion?
I have moved it.
Okay, Representative Berger moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3432. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Amendment is adopted. And, yes, Representative Hunt.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 8 amendments to 3432.
Representative Hunt moves the dash 8 amendments to House Bill 3432. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Okay, without objection, the dash 8s are adopted. And Representative Hunt.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 3432 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hunt moves House Bill 3432 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Yes, and Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had lots of testimony on this, none of which convinced me that there is a significant enough problem with the makeup of the DPSST board to vote to change it at this time. It was my suggestion that over the interim, maybe some work could be done from the advocates of this bill and the DPSST board. There was some significant movement from the time this first came on my radar, but I am still unconvinced that this is the answer to a problem that I guess I'm not seeing, so I will not support this bill.
Thank you for your comment. Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, I'm very much supportive of this bill. I think in many of our boards that we have that regulate different professions, the actual frontline people who are part of that profession are part of that regulatory process, and I think it's a healthy thing to do to have the people who are on the front line be part of the a process to make sure the profession is held to the highest standards. So I am very supportive of the bill.
Thank you. And yes, Representative Esquivel.
I thank you, Madam Chair. I have to agree with my colleague from Salem that I'm seeing a procedural process here being taken care of by changing the board instead of the procedure. I also feel that when it comes to certification, the people that are involved in this board have been frontline people. They've proven themselves, and they've proven themselves to the point of where they moved up into the organization to be part of the management team. So, therefore, I will not be supporting this bill either.
For the discussion, yes, Representative Hunt.
Representative Aswell is going to agree with Representative Berger, then I'm going to have to agree with the representative from Ashland. I think especially as we look at other bodies in the state, in any profession that the state is involved in licensure or certification, there's just, as we heard in the testimony, there is no other board like the DPSST is organized. And this, by creating this certification review committee as a policy committee within the DPSST, I think we take a step toward making them much more like the other certifying and licensure bodies. They still have much more management representation than any of those other ones, but by having that balance and frankly also a much smaller group in the certification review group, I think that will begin to address the problem, and there is a problem. It's been, I think the DPSST board has finally acknowledged, as they said, within the last 6 weeks the problem, but the challenge has been there for a lot longer than that. I personally appreciate the fact that the whole arbitration issue has been pulled out of this, that we're just dealing with some structural issues to make the DPSST and the new certification review committee more functional. So I would encourage us to adopt the bill.
Okay. Thank you for the comments, members. And Shannon, would you please call the roll?
No.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Berger?
No.
Buckley?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries. And House Bill 3432 will go to the floor. Representative Hudson, through the chief sponsor of this, would you like to carry it on the floor? Okay. Representative Hunt will carry the bill.
I don't want to take this one.
I will close the work session on House Bill 3432. And I will open a work session on House Bill 3088. And Mr. Stenberg?
Madam Chair, House Bill 3088 is another one that you've heard before. This one is the one that prohibits hospitals from billing or attempting to collect from uninsured patients charges that exceed their Medicare rates or rates paid by hospitals' highest volume commercial insurer. You have the -5 amendment from Representative Berger, A5.
And before we look at that, I think that when we heard this bill on Monday, I did say that because there was some confusion that morning about whether we were having a public hearing, that we would allow limited additional testimony. And I don't know if we don't have a sign-up sheet, but I believe we have two people who wanted to speak on it, Ellen Lowe and Diana Gernhardt. So if you... Oh, I'm sorry, just a moment. Is Kevin Earls here? Kevin, did you wish to testify? Okay, please come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kevin Earls, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I'm joined by Ellen Lowe. Our community advocate. And Madam Chair, just for the record, we have others that have traveled to be here to testify on the bill before you today as well, both from OHSU that traveled down from Portland, and we have two people here from Salem Hospital. So we'll be brief as we can, but this is, for most of us, our first opportunity to address the bill before this committee. For the record, I'm Kevin Earls, Vice President for Policy and Advocacy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I'm joined by Ellen Lowe, Consumer Advocate for OAHHS, on behalf of Oregon's 57 acute care hospitals throughout the state, our healthcare systems, and the patients we serve. We'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3088 this morning and discuss our reasons for opposing the bill. First, what the bill does, and Mr. Stembridge has given you the overview. In its current form, 3088 imposes a legal requirement on Oregon hospitals to provide a uniform method of discounting for patients who are uninsured, and it subjects hospitals who are not able to meet those requirements to treble damages and attorney costs. But I'd like to tell you about what the bill doesn't do, because I think that, frankly, that's where the rub is. First, it doesn't recognize that all Oregon hospitals already provide discounts to people who either lack insurance or who are unable to afford the care that they receive in Oregon hospitals. Every Oregon hospital has a policy in place that either provides a discount or financial assistance for these people. These policies exist at every one of our hospitals, but they vary. They aren't uniform in the sense that the bill provides, and that is an important distinction for reasons that we'll explore with you. We've brought copies of those policies for you, for the committee. We have some bound copies, but printed copies that are available to the public and on the World Wide Web relating to those policies throughout Oregon. Since 2005, these policies have been posted on the web to ensure that there's unfettered public access to them. Second, the bill doesn't focus on the financial circumstances of the individual, but rather on their insurance status. There are many Oregonians who have insurance but still need assistance in meeting the cost of their hospital stay or hospital treatment. To be effective, hospitals know that they must look beyond the insurance issue to determine how to assist those people with financial needs. This is becoming an increasing issue for people and for hospitals for two reasons. First of all, as you know, personal cost sharing in employer-sponsored healthcare coverage is increasing. As healthcare premiums have gone up, employers have responded by increasing deductibles. This subjects people and families to increasing liability and cost sharing annually in their policies. Second of all, with the proliferation of medical savings accounts that contain high annual deductibles for the insured, people have new and often previously unexperienced exposure in just meeting their annual deductible. They may have a $10,000 deductible or level of self-insurance in their medical savings account policy. And in that way, House Bill 3088 misses the point. Third, there's no residency requirement in this measure. While the sponsors of House Bill 3088 surely intend for it to address the needs of Oregonians, the bill requires discounts to be provided regardless of the state of residency. Hospitals routinely provide service to patients in neighboring states, as hospital service areas know no borders. They don't stop at the state border. But a bill intended to benefit Oregonians should be limited to those who are, in fact, Oregonians. 3088 does not do that. Fourth, the bill lacks any limitation for medical necessity. House Bill 3088 requires a discount for any hospital service provided to someone without insurance, but it doesn't distinguish between those who actually have resources to pay their bill for the services that they're ordering or purchasing versus those that do not. Again, hospital policies look beyond just whether you have insurance or not and look to issues like medical necessity, financial resources, and other issues. Actually, much of the demand for self-pay patients in which a hospital actually receives payment are for services that are elective in nature and are not deemed medically necessary, something that you'll hear more about in a bit. Fifth, the bill provides no means for a hospital to determine or verify a patient's insurance status. It's all about providing a discount to people who are uninsured, but we have no way to determine whether, in fact, people are insured or to verify their assertion that they are uninsured. From an operational perspective, this is very challenging for hospitals. When a level of discounting provided in House Bill 3088 is higher than the discount that a person would receive through their own insurance program, especially if they're in a high deductible program or a medical savings account, there's going to be an automatic temptation to get the higher discount because you're self-paying for that service either way. So a hospital has to be able to determine, is the person truly self or uninsured? Sixth, House Bill 3088 provides no allowance for differences in the level of uninsurance in various communities around Oregon. These are what I would characterize as differences in demand. But you know, based on your own experience in your own districts, that there are varying degrees of uninsurance, varying rates of uninsurance from one county to the next in the state. So Douglas County has a very high rate of uninsurance. Another county, perhaps Washington County, may have a very low rate of uninsurance. But this bill does not distinguish, and it places that uneven burden on the shoulders of the local hospital. Seventh, House Bill 3088 assumes that all hospitals have the same kind of financial resources to address the problem of the uninsured. And I will tell you from our own perspective, there are 57 community hospitals in the state of Oregon. And when you look at their financial picture, there are 57 very different snapshots. On any given year, a third of Oregon hospitals are losing money. And very often these are small and rural hospitals in rural and frontier counties around Oregon. So many of our small and rural hospitals have told us that if they're subject to the broad level of expectations put forward in House Bill 3088, they're concerned about their financial stability and their ability to keep their doors open. Eighth, ninth, a bill lacks the definition of a highest volume insurer. That's something Mr. Stembridge mentioned at the outset. In the summary of the bill, it refers to choosing a rate that's either the Medicare rate or the rate paid by a hospital's highest volume commercial insurer. But I would point out that the bill doesn't actually say that. It says service by Medicare or the hospital's highest volume insurer, not commercial. Medicare is an insurer, and so it provides no choice for a hospital if they're literally having to choose between Medicare and Medicare. So we think that absent clarification on that, there's a real problem with the bill, especially given that Medicare pays less than cost for services. Finally, 3088 creates a significant fiscal impact for hospitals in the state, and I'd like to cite a couple of examples. First, there's OHSU. Their fiscal impact is estimated to be over $6 million. And we have representatives from OHSU that will walk through their analysis and explain why the impact is so significant for them. Several of the mitigating factors or contributing factors for that are things that I've mentioned so far in the bill. But they're not alone. There are seven district hospitals in this state that operate only by virtue of a local tax base that helps subsidize their operations, meaning that they're not able to keep their doors open simply on the revenue that they get from providing patient services. So they have a local tax base. House Bill 3088 will create a new unfunded mandate for hospitals that are in that situation. For each of those hospitals, the impact of that local mandate or that local unfunded impact will be different. But we know that it's significant for some. We don't have yet a opportunity to evaluate the impact on those hospitals. Finally, I'd like to tell you that there are kind of two issues at play in 3088. One is the demand side, which is how many uninsured people does a hospital have in its catchment area? And that varies dramatically from hospital to hospital and county to county, as I described. The statewide uninsurance rate in Oregon is about 15.6%, according to the most recent current population survey. But the range of uninsurance is from about 13.5% on one end to about 25% in counties on the other end. So the point is that there is a huge fluctuation in the kind of the demand side, but similarly, hospitals have a huge variation in their ability to provide financial assistance as provided in 3088. For some, this will be no problem. It's implied in their current policies. For others, this is a sweeping new challenge. And so we did a brief analysis looking at the counties that are served by Oregon hospitals and their current household income and their operating margin. And I'll be providing copies of this to the committee as a follow-up. But I'd like to tell you that there are 11 counties in Oregon right now that are being served by hospitals that have negative operating margins, meaning that they're not able to break even based on patient care. So obviously a measure that creates a new uniform approach, as 3088 does, provides additional peril for those hospitals in those counties and the Oregon residents that live there. Ellen Rowe is going to talk briefly about the way we've tried to approach this as an industry in Oregon with a combination of what we think of as flexibility, allowing hospitals to address the community need based on what they have available to work with as a hospital, plus having the accountability that we feel is absolutely essential for those hospitals to disclose and be fully accountable for what they're doing for the hospitals in exchange for their tax status.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and as Kevin said, a community advocate for, and I would emphasize to, the Oregon hospital system. This is a new position for them, and it's a new role for me. I really appreciate the opportunity today for you to hear about the transparency that currently exists and the opportunity that House Bill 3290 provides for future accountability. House Bill 3088 does not advance affordability. I distributed copies of 3290 for your review this morning, so you can see what you approved this session with no negative votes. And I do believe that you will see that the required reporting will provide for understandable transparency and accountability with flexibility rather than uniformity, because it calls for a uniform standard reporting system so you and the public you represent will be able to view the community benefits that are offered and the financial assistance plans that are available. And this is going to be in what I would describe as a user-friendly format, because it isn't always easy to go from one place to another to find information. And so this will be there for you. It'll be there for local hospitals and communities. I'd also invite you to join Kevin in the review of those financial assistance guidelines, particularly for your local area. And you will find that the hospitals really have been called to establish guidelines that are consistent and standardized, but that address income levels, cultural accessibility, and consumer information while allowing for community needs. These guidelines suggest that the response to local needs may be quite different in the South Coast, where many of my contemporaries have chosen to move, than they might be in Lake County or perhaps here in Salem. Not only may the financial assistance plans be different, they should be. And you will be able to see this in these reports. You'll also be provided information on the participation of Medicare and Medicaid patients in your local hospital patient mix. And this may explain why many hospitals are the economic engine within their community. They are operating at an economic loss. And when you see the number of Medicare and Medicaid patients accessing your area hospitals, it really will explain some of the relative health of these institutions. And you will see that it isn't just distance from another hospital or the size of the hospital, but also the populations they serve that influences the financial assistance plans and the community benefit plans that are developed. You have heard that testimony that 3088 doesn't provide for means testing of the uninsured. I would suggest that it doesn't allow for means testing of the 57 acute care Oregon hospitals either. You are familiar, I believe, with the commitment of the hospitals to the restoration of the Oregon Health Plan as it was originally envisioned. And that purpose was to serve all Oregonians who were living in poverty. And so this we would advance would be another way of dealing with the problems for those who are currently without insurance but are living in poverty. 3088 does not advance medically necessary health services, as you have just heard, to Oregon's most financially vulnerable, nor does it reflect local differences. Again, you have approved House Bill 3290, which will encourage community responsiveness and participation. And as the community advocate for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, I invite you to participate with your local hospitals and your community health service collaboratives in this accountability effort. This, along with restoring the Oregon Health Plan standard, has the best promise of assisting the financially fragile who are currently uninsured. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions, as would Kevin.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for these witnesses? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Kevin, as you were testifying, I was thinking of a few hospitals that I know of that have closed in the past few years. I remember one particularly in an old neighborhood I lived in was Woodland Park. And I'm just wondering, how many hospitals have closed in Oregon the past few years and why? What was the prevailing reason?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I have the information in my briefcase, but from recollection, I believe three hospitals have closed in recent years. And in every instance, it's really the result of being unable to sustain financial viability. So, I like to think about what our hospitals do and our customers. We have three customers. We have Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial insurance predominantly, and some self-pay, which is the focus of this bill. But two of those, Medicaid and Medicare, pay hospitals below cost. And as a result, hospitals must make that money up with what they charge to commercial. And as a consequence, when a hospital is unable to make that balancing act work, they close their doors. And there are pressures that bear directly on that. To give you an example, Medicaid is one of the issues that's within your control, your collective control as a body. And when you fund Medicaid well, meaning you cover enough people and you pay something approximating cost to hospitals and healthcare providers, then the system works well. But as we've seen in Oregon with the layoff of about 80,000 people out of the Oregon Health Plan and declining rates, what's actually happened overall in Oregon is that uncompensated care for hospitals has gone from $405 million in 2003 to $751 million in 2006. So you see, if you were to look at two charts that I'll provide as follow-up, you will see a decline in the enrollment in the Oregon Health Plan and a corresponding ramping up by $350 million in uncompensated care to Oregon hospitals during the same time period. The takeaway I would tell you from that is that in some instances, hospitals can't adapt to that level of cost shifting that's occurring. And in other instances, this phenomenon is absorbing unbelievable amounts of resources out of a hospital as they try and respond at a community level to pick up for the care that has been unfunded or defunded through the legislative process.
Other questions for these witnesses? Kevin, you made a comment, I think, that hospitals would have no way of determining if people are uninsured if this bill passes, and it seems to me you must already be making that determination as you're handling a lot of people without insurance as well as even more people that have insurance. So why wouldn't you use the same method that you currently use to process those claims?
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. What I think you would find if you reviewed the policies that we provided in the binders is that hospitals don't look strictly at what is your level of insurance or what is your insurance status. What they're trying to find out is, can you afford to pay your hospital bill? So they're looking at things like income and some level of understanding of what the employment situation is, et cetera. But this bit takes a different approach. It says whether or not you should get this discount is based on whether or not you have insurance. So we don't have the same approach as is prescribed in this bill. An issue that we're trying to make clear to you today, we feel, is moving in the wrong direction.
And I think when I've been hospitalized, which I have been a couple of times, I have never been asked my income level, but I think it's because I have always had at least one insurance plan that covered me. So I assume those questions you're talking about, you ask of uninsured people.
Chair Rosenbaum, I think the experience, and I share this experience with you, when you go to the hospital asks for your insurance card so they can take a picture of it. Usually that's one of the first things that happens in the admission process. But the challenge in 3088 is if a person alleges that they don't have insurance, there's no way for the hospital to disprove that negative. So say I have a medical savings account and I have a $10,000 deductible, and House Bill 3088 says, I'm entitled, if I'm uninsured, to a discount that's equal to Medicare, which is below cost. Well, that's certainly a lower price for whatever I'm going to have done than I would pay through my catastrophic medical savings account policy. So I go to the hospital and I say, well, I'm going to have to self-pay this anyway because the first $10,000 is my own problem. Why wouldn't I just say I don't have insurance? Because I'm going to get the lower rate. I'm going to get the Medicare rate. Why would I want to show them my medical savings account policy card and pay an automatically higher rate? It might be, 30% higher. So the problem from the hospital's point of view is they don't have any way to vet that assertion on the part of the individual.
Okay, any other questions for these witnesses? Thank you very much for your testimony. I am not sure, since we haven't got a sign-up sheet, I have several names of people who I think might want to testify. And Diana Gernhardt, is she here? And Aaron Crane and Cheryl Vore. please come forward.
Madam Chair, my name is Cheryl Hoare, and I'm the community relations person at Salem Hospital at 665 Winter Street Southeast, your local hospital if you need health care while you're in session. with me today is Aaron Crane, our chief financial officer. I am not going to read from my testimony, which I'm sure you will enjoy. And there's some examples in there that we'd like to call to your attention. Specifically, we want to echo Ellen Lowe's comments about House Bill 3290. We think that's going to be a great resource to help legislators and the community know the community benefits that hospitals provide beyond the direct health care that we provide to everyone. We're here today, however, in opposition of House Bill 3088 in mandating the amount that hospitals charge to a subset of its patients. We believe that this bill limits the abilities of hospitals to meet the needs of their communities. And as the community relations person at the hospital, I have the opportunity to either be involved in or understand a lot of what we do in the community benefit realm. And I just want to touch on a couple of those before I turn it over to Aaron to talk about our actual policies around financial assistance, which we're quite proud of. When we make our decisions about our budget every year, we are looking at how do we meet the unmet needs of the community, as well as how do we support the increases in community needs as far as the types of health care that we provide at the bedside. So one of the things that we do is we look at, are there unmet needs in areas that can improve the health care of the community? One of the examples I'd like to bring to your attention is our Family Birth Center Clinic. We opened the Family Birth Center in 2003. Then we opened in late 2005 our Family Birth Center Clinic. The clinic is staffed full-time, 24 hours a day, by OB hospitalists. Those are obstetricians who do not have a private practice. They actually practice at the hospital. They're there 24 hours a day and always available to deal with births. The reason we opened the clinic is because we were experiencing women coming to the hospital who had never had prenatal care. And I think we all know that prenatal care is an essential insurance policy toward helping make sure that babies come out healthy. So we, when we open the clinic, our primary patient mix in the clinic are women who have no insurance, or they have insurance and they're unable to get a physician at that time of their pregnancy, or they have high-risk pregnancies. And this clinic is not in competition with any other clinics in town or any other doctors in town. In fact, because they're there 24 hours a day, they are able to help with be backup to OBs who maybe couldn't get to the hospital as quickly as the mom's delivering. They're also able to, we had a few of those interesting ones. they're also able to be backup if there's a problem with the delivery and there needs to be an emergency surgery. So there's already a doctor there. Since we've opened that clinic, we are now delivering through that clinic about 600 births per year, and at an uncovered cost to the hospital through our community benefit of in excess of $500,000 per year. A couple other things I'd like to point out for community benefit. We also offer free or very low-cost facilities to organizations. So, for example, the Marion Polk County Medical Society. Some of you may be familiar with their MediAssist program that helps people who cannot afford prescriptions but who have serious medical conditions or chronic conditions and need those prescriptions. We provide them with free office space so that they can manage that program, and they are able every month to acquire about an average of 7,500 prescriptions for the community. I also handed out to you a copy of our latest newsletter, The Messenger. That is something that we do to the community. It goes out to every household in Marion and Polk County. Its purpose is to help people be better informed and more confident healthcare consumers, to help them learn the tools, the treatments, the particularly prevention things that they need to do to in order to be healthier. So those are just some examples that when we have the flexibility that we feel we need in our budget to meet community needs, that we are able to do. And I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Crane, and then we'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Berger. Nice to see you all. Thank you for the time this morning. My name is Aaron Crane. I'm the Senior Vice President of Operations and Finance at Salem Hospital. And would like to just add on to Cheryl's comments. I've handed out kind of a five-page PowerPoint I'll go through very quickly for you and be happy to answer questions. But with respect to our financial assistance policy, the first matrix is just showing you our discount practice. And at the very bottom, it shows right now we are giving everybody who is uninsured a 15% discount across the top. And how we arrived at that is looking at our basically our commercial discount average. So of all the commercial payers we have, what's the average discount? And we give that to everybody without insurance already. And then further, we have a sliding scale that from 0 to 200% of the federal poverty level, we do discount 100% as charity. And then we have the sliding scale you see up to 400% of the federal poverty level. In our experience in working with across looking at national benchmarks and national programs on this over the past few years, we feel very confident we're in the on the front of the averages and of what's happening across the country with this. Talking more about just summarizing the policy, which is attached to this document, what we do is any patient who comes in with a balance greater than $500, we automatically screen for eligibility in government programs. So sometimes they have access to coverage that they aren't aware of. We help them with Oregon Health Plan coverage, with COBRA, if there are benefits out there from a previous job. We help them get lined up with that, and also with the Family Health Assistance Program, FIA. And then we look at, we have our eligibility tiers that I just presented. We look at their a simple income test to help see where they fit within that. Our policy also covers catastrophic limits. We cap the medical expense that we hold a patient to a maximum of 30% of their annual income. And we also, in our policy, protect the first $225,000 in equity in a primary residence. So we came up with that one basically looking at the average home value in the Salem area, and that's why we wanted to preserve that. We don't put liens on homes, and that's been a big thing in the press, so we wanted to make sure that's documented in our policy. In terms of communication, we post that financial assistance is available in all the key areas, whether it's admitting, the emergency department, where outpatients come for registration, and in our business office where patients may come for billing and collections questions. And this is posted in both English and in Spanish. Our conditions of admissions form that a patient signs at the beginning of the process also highlights the opportunity for charity assistance. The first patient statement we send out again gives notification of the opportunity for financial assistance, and all of these written forms are available again in English and in Spanish, and we also have interpreter services available for people who don't speak English, so we want to make sure we're communicating with all of our patients. And finally, our financial assistance policy is available on our website as well, so we are doing everything we can to make this as publicly available as possible. So, kind of in conclusion, from my perspective, I believe Salem Hospital has implemented a very comprehensive program for providing financial assistance to those in need. I think we're a fortunate community here when you look at the mix of commercial payer and government-sponsored programs. From an economic standpoint, we do understand our role as a tax-exempt organization and make sure we're providing services to the underinsured. But I think it's important to note, too, that the community standards are different in every community in Oregon. We at a meeting last month with my counterparts from across the state, it was very clear different financial officers and different organizations have different perspectives on what they can really do in their community around this issue. But I believe that with the current pricing pressure, with the transparency activities, and with the latest community benefit legislation that's passed through here this session, there is more than adequate to ensure that the hospital industry in the state is fulfilling its obligation to the communities we serve in terms of the uninsured patient's obligations for services provided. So with that, I'll conclude. Thank you again, and happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for these witnesses? Yes, Representative Hunt. Yes.
Thank you, Randy. At the newsletter, I noticed you've got a picture in here of Dave Fiscom in an article about heart attacks. One of the pieces of advice here is a picture of Dave Fiscom in front of the Capitol and says, "Don't just think you can endure this unknown discomfort. Is that a reference to the Capitol?
We're spending time with Dave, right?
Good comeback.
Okay, I don't think you have to answer that.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Beringer, and I'm with Oregon Health and Science University, and I just wanted to take a quick moment to introduce Diana Gernhardt, who is here to explain and walk the committee through the assumptions and our fiscal impact. And then I'm available if you have any questions about how the fiscal impact process works at OHSU, because we're a public corporation. It's a little bit different, but it still falls in that state agency fiscal impact process. I'll turn it over to Diana.
Hi, Madam Chair and the rest of the committee. As Brian mentioned, I kind of wanted to walk through how I prepared our fiscal analysis of how this bill, as it stands from the latest that I know, the impact to OHSU. As Kevin mentioned, it's a $6.3 million impact based on our largest commercial payer. It would increase to $8.7 million.
Sorry, could you identify yourself for the record, please?
I'm sorry. Diana Gernhardt, Associate Hospital Director for OHSU Hospital and Clinics. As I was mentioning, the fiscal impact based on the largest commercial payer would be $6.3 million to OHSU. If it was based on the Medicare payment rate, it would be $8.7 million. How I looked at this information was I first looked at all of our non-sponsored payer class within OHSU. It's approximately 5% of our entire business. It doesn't seem much, but it is a big dollar amount. 4.5% of that 5% actually qualify for our charity care policy or our bad debt write-off. So we're talking in this bill only about 0.5% of our business at OHSU. In evaluating it a little bit further, I broke it out between the Oregon residents as well as non-Oregon. For the non-Oregon, because of who we are and the services we provide, sometimes the sole provider on a lot of services, we receive cases from out of the state, whether it's Oregon or Washington, Montana, but even international patients. And it's because of our transplant program. We had a heart transplant, a bone marrow transplant program, also our neuro services that we provide, and oncology, particularly in our pediatric program at Dornbecker. So that represents one-third of that fiscal impact, or $2.1 million out of the $6.3. The other component is the Oregon residents. And we have, as Aaron mentioned, we also work with our patients to actively get them on any type of insurance that they're eligible for. So most of our patients, we work on getting them on the Oregon Health Plan as well as any other coverage so that they would fall into at least some type of coverage. At least if it wasn't for the care we provided, it would be for their next encounter, whether it's at Lacey Improv or even another institution within the state. So looking at the services that did meet this impact, they were primarily elective services like bariatric surgery as well as plastic surgery. So they're truly elective services that folks want and elected to receive since their health plan or whatever the case may be did not cover them. And or the other category is that they didn't meet medical necessity from their insurance payer. So that was kind of the categories when I looked at the services that we provided to summarize what that fiscal impact would be for us. Do you have any questions for me?
Any questions? Yes, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, ma'am. Sure, perhaps you can just help me with you with the thought process. Do you take into account the number of uninsured patients that you have, and even in that 0.5%, when you set the prices for what they're going to pay, do you take into account the fact that you're not going to collect a certain percentage of that money from those people? Is that a given in your calculations?
No. It's assumed that we would receive the 100% of the price. And typically, as I mentioned, these are elective, so actually we ask for the money up front.
Oh, okay.
And that's why we know it's primarily elective, because they decide, yes, I do want to proceed with the nose or whatever it may be, and they pay up front.
Given that if they pay up front, then how does this bill impact that procedure if they pay up front as it is?
I'm assuming that it would be at a discount rate versus at our full rate. Okay. So this is based on they would pay at a discounted price.
Other questions for these witnesses? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3088? Yeah, and we'll let the proponents have one more shot to respond then. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Okay, why don't you come forward?
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Marie Kreider. I, of course, testified the other day, so I'll try to be very brief, simply responding to some of the points that were made today. I would point out that if the patients that are receiving, that were taken into account in OHSU's fiscal were insured, but doing elective procedures that are not covered in their insurance plan, the bill does not apply to them because the bill applies to billing of people without insurance coverage that do not have a plan. Let me address a couple of other points that were made. First, this bill does not supplant hospital financial assistance and charity care programs. It simply creates a baseline that says for uninsured folks, hospitals cannot charge them more than this. As in all of the voluntary financial assistance policies that exist in the state already, you may have an uninsured program that applies to all insured and standing beside a charity care program. So I think this adds an element of fairness to people of moderate income, and so on, to all Oregonians while leaving in place hospital charity care programs. I think there's also been some lack of clarity about whether the bill requires hospitals to charge uninsured people the Medicare rate. It does not. It allows the hospital to choose that if in some circumstance that is more advantageous to the hospital. As you probably know, the Medicare and Medicaid programs do pay at cost for the type A and B rural hospitals and the critical access hospitals. So I suppose it's conceivable that some of those hospitals that are being paid better by the Medicare program than the urban hospitals might choose it. My assumption is that even for them, the largest commercial payer will be paying a somewhat higher rate, and they'll elect that as the bill allows them to do. In terms of the requirement that the fact that the bill requires a hospital to ascertain whether or not a person has insurance, I think that is something that hospitals now do. Many of the charity care programs of hospitals only provide charity care to people without insurance. Some of them apply also, as I think Salem Hospital indicated to you, that they have a catastrophic program that would help people even if they had insurance under some circumstances. So I think that is not something that's new in this bill. I think maybe the most concerning point that is made by the opponents of this bill is the notion that some hospitals simply can't afford to do automatic discount for all people without insurance. And I would point out to you in that regard that some of the hospitals that are already doing discounts equal to what they do, their largest commercial insurer, are hospitals located in areas with high numbers of people without insurance, and hospitals that are not doing not rolling in dough, so to speak. Our example of Curry General Hospital, that gives a 40% discount to all people without insurance. St. Elizabeth's out in Baker City that does that with respect to people that agree to pay within 18 months. These are hospitals in area that are not wealthy hospitals, but they have made a decision to do that, I think, because it's a justice issue, and that's what we're bringing to you. I would also point out to you that it's very easy to administer, much easier for the hospital to administer than an elaborate means test. And so I think that it is possible for hospitals to do this. OHSU is pretty typical. We're talking about a very small slice of the population, in fact, that the bill would apply to. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there any questions for this witness? Yes, Representative Roblin.
Just one, and that has to do with the, if I was going to elect a surgeon, I'd check with my insurance company, and they said they weren't going to pay anything. I don't know that, you know, when you go to the hospital, you would say you have insurance. And how is the insurance, how would the hospital, like OHSU, figure that out? I mean, if I say I don't have insurance, I don't know if they can have any way of knowing if I do or don't. And that's the only issue that I've found today that was interested me when we're talking about elective surgery. So they wouldn't be honest, but they would just say, I don't have the insurance, and how would they be able to charge them that price? They'd have to give them a discount, I would expect.
Representative Roblin, I don't know what they do to check at this point. I assume they check it. Other records in terms of whether they've seen that person before and whether they have insurance. I do know that a number of hospitals already have these kinds of automatic uninsurance discounts. Apparently, they have some faith that most of their fellow citizens are honest and telling them the truth.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Follow up on Representative Roblin's question. And there seems to be some difference of reading of the bill in terms of, I think there's a common reading of the bill in terms of it would cover those who, you know, not cover those who have insurance for procedures that are being covered. But if I mean, there's only some folks who testified earlier, and I think it's a legitimate reading of the bill to say, if we're talking about services in excess of the amount paid to the hospital for the same service by Medicare, the hospital's highest volume, you know, if my insurance covers bariatric surgery and Representative Thatcher's insurance does not, it would seem to me like in that case I would be insured and she would be uninsured, at least for that service. Help me understand why, because we're clearly getting two different reads of the same language.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, the definition of uninsured is at page 1, line 11, and it reads, uninsured means not enrolled in any public or private health benefit plan. So it speaks to enrollment rather than to the specific service. That's the reason. I mean, it could have been written differently, but that's the way I read it.
So,
follow up.
Thank you. So would that mean someone who's enrolled in, I mean, there are some very scaled down kind of basic benefit plans that really don't cover much at all. Are you saying that someone who had one of those plans would therefore not qualify for the benefits of this on any procedures, whether they were part of their plan or not?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, The term private health benefit plan as defined in ORS Chapter 743 means that it isn't going to, if you're enrolled in a program that, say, only covers medical related to accidents or only covers prescription drugs or something like that, then it would not be, you would be uninsured under this bill. However, it is true that if you had a very high deductible plan, you would not be treated as uninsured. You would not have the benefit of this. And if you needed assistance, it would have to be under a hospital's voluntary financial assistance program.
Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. On line 14, I'm front of the bill talks about Medicare or the hospital's highest volume insurer. It was mentioned by the Salem Hospital folks, I think, that Medicare is an insurer, and in a lot of cases for hospitals that is the highest volume insurer. So the word commercial up here in the summary didn't make it down here, I guess, and I'm wondering if you'd noticed that. I think that's what they're talking about, when there wouldn't be any choice.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, I actually hadn't read the summary because obviously it is the text of the bill that controls. But I think two things. One, Medicare is not an insurer in the sense that we at a state law level look at who is an insurer. I mean, Medicare is not subject to the insurance laws. So I don't think it's a reasonable reading to say that when given a choice between Medicare and the largest volume insurer, that it means Medicare or Medicare. I mean, that's not a reasonable reading of the bill. I would also point out that the next sentence after the one you read says, a hospital must choose one payer scale for charges for all uninsured and patients, and I understand that to mean that they must choose either to peg their charges to Medicare or to the largest volume insurer. So that gives me another reason to believe that we're talking about a choice there.
Okay, any other questions for this witness? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3088? Okay, members, I'm going to temporarily close the work session on House Bill 3088. I'm doing that because a couple of members have had to leave for signing ceremonies and want to be able to vote on this bill, and we'll be back shortly. So we have, I think, two more items remaining on our agenda.
Yes. While we are in open session and not don't have any open bills, I would like to serve notice of possible minority report on House Bill 3432.
Okay. We'll consider ourselves on notice. And let's open a work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 17.
I'm sure SCR 17 honors Daniel O. Bernstein, president of Portland State University, for his leadership at Portland State University and his service to Oregon from 1997 to 2007.
Okay. We are, I guess this was only posted for a work session. Is there anybody here that wishes to testify on this resolution? Okay. Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 17 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Representative Buckley moves SCR 17 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay. Shauna, please call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
excused.
Patrick.
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused. Aye. Motion carries. And oh, great.
No, she's an absentee carrier.
Okay, so we will assign Representative Nolan as the carrier of this bill. And if she does not, for some reason, able to carry it, I will carry it. Okay. Seems to be the only person from Portland in this committee. So. Okay, and I'll close the work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 17. And we have one additional item of business, and that is possible introduction of drafts for committee bills. So I will open a work session for that purpose. And do the members have LC?
We do not. I have copies available. People would like to see it.
So, members, this is a priority request, and the Speaker has given us permission to introduce it as a committee bill, which is what I was requested to do. So I would entertain a motion to introduce LC 3920 as a committee bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kent.
I move that we introduce LC 3920 as a committee bill.
Okay, Representative Hunt has moved that LC 3920 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there discussion? Is there...
Madam Chair, I'd just like to clarify. This is the relating two clauses to Public Safety Strategies Task Force.
Okay.
For those listening in who may be thinking this is very mysterious.
Overly broad.
For that clarification. And okay, is there objection to the motion? Okay, seeing none, so ordered. And that will be introduced as a committee bill. And members, that is the only thing that we have remaining. We do intend to do a work session on House Bill 3088, and so I guess the committee will stand at ease for just a few moments while we wait for the absent members who wish to vote to return. The committee will stand at ease. And members, we are still in a work session on House Bill 3088. Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3088 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Sun. I'm sorry. Could you hold your motion?
Madam Chair, I withdraw my motion.
Okay. Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, I have submitted the -5 amendments to House Bill 3588. I'd like to move them. I'll discuss them once you...
Representative Berger moves the -5 amendments to House Bill 3088.
Madam Chair, the -5 amendments to House Bill 3088 basically reduce the bill to the Section 4, which requires that hospitals have a cogent policy on rates for the uninsured and that this policy be freely available to patients and the public. It does not mandate rates on a private entity, which is what the heart of this bill is and what I consider to be terribly egregious. I think hospitals have been very responsive overall, and I think 3088, as currently construed, is very bad policy, but I would submit that if the public needs more notification, then the -5 amendments would be a very good way of going.
Further discussion on the amendments? Okay, I think we need to call the roll on this one. Shauna, would you please call the roll?
Representative Roblin.
No.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Buckley.
No.
Representative
Estrell.
Aye. Representative Hunt.
No.
Chair Rosenbaum.
No. Motion fails.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3088 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Buckley moves House Bill 3088A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colleagues, to me, this comes down to an issue of fairness. Bankruptcy is at an increasing rate, the number one cost for bankruptcy in the United States right now are health care costs. The number one driver of health care bankruptcies is the cost of hospital care that families, particularly uninsured families, experience. And I do grant the hospitals are doing everything they can in terms of developing good programs. The fairness comes in for me in that the cost of the service should be what the patient and the patient's family is billed for. And that is why I'm in support of House Bill 3088.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I previously indicated, I think this is about some of the worst policy I have ever seen. We had clear testimony in here today that one size does not fit all, that 11 counties have hospitals with negative operating models, and in some of our rural areas, you lose your hospital, and boy, are you in deep doo-doo. And that doesn't means test uninsured. It doesn't means test either the uninsured or the hospitals under this policy. It just simply says we're just going to rate cap you. Never mind what the needs are, never mind what the costs are. I cannot support this bill. I am adamantly opposed to this bill. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, I agree with my colleague from, Madam Chair, I agree with my colleague from Salem. Not only that, it's that when I was on the city council, it seemed like we were inevitably fighting for our local autonomy and our local rights. And here we're back here in Salem again, dictating to people how they need to run their business. But more importantly, it's going to affect every hospital with every individual in this room. and we're telling them what they need to do or how they need to run their organizations. And some of these hospitals, example, you take the smaller ones like Lakeview, Burns, the very remote communities, it's going to hurt them dramatically. So, therefore, I have to be a no on this.
Further discussion? Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm probably somewhere in between my colleagues on this. I've definitely seen far worse bills than this. Point out the last couple of bills that we voted on, some of them on the House floor. I'd be happy to recollect your memory, colleague. I think the core goal here is right on. I think the frustrating thing for me is in hearing from the opponents and the proponents of the bill, there is agreement on the real core solution, which is broader insurance coverage. And I appreciate the fact that the opponents and the proponents of this bill in particular, once this bill is away from us, we'll be right back to working on that common ground, and that's clearly the ultimate solution. I think the core goal here is right on. I just think the implementation is off by removing a revenue stream from these hospitals, especially hospitals like the one that serves my area, that are not operating with some major profit that they can dig into, I just think is a misguided implementation. I spent several days, maybe it's been weeks, trying to find an amendment that would more narrowly focus the bill on actually serving those who are at the low end income-wise and making sure that their rates were capped without removing a revenue stream from these hospitals. It became apparent to me just in the last 24 hours that there, at least from my perspective, there was not an amendment that was going to bring the two sides on this issue closer together. So I, honoring a commitment I had made earlier, I will be a courtesy yes out of committee. I will be a no on this bill on the floor.
Additional comments? I would just comment that I think this is a complicated area, and there's no doubt that there's not one solution to healthcare affordability, but it seems to me that the testimony we've heard that people without insurance are being charged roughly twice what people with insurance are charged in our state is just not right, and that we have also heard that at least one of the largest hospital systems in our state is already essentially following what the bill calls for and doing so by court order. And I don't think we should have to have more lawsuits to simply say that if you are without insurance, you should be able to pay the rates that people with insurance are paying. So I am persuaded that this bill is worth moving forward, and I will be voting aye. And seeing no one further who wishes to comment, Shauna, will you please call the roll?
No.
No.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Buckley, would you like to carry this on the floor?
I would be happy to, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Okay, and members, with nothing further to come before us today, we are adjourned.